Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for your free 30-day trial.
Taking you to nonpartisan places you've never been to and leaving you there. It's Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
I realize that the election that we're having right now, which is off into completely unprecedented territory, as we all know, I mean, this is the most unusual, interesting, controversial election of my lifetime, and it's definitely breaking new ground in a lot of ways, and I know it's scaring a lot of people. And I get it. There are potential historical avenues that might loom in our future that if we went down that road, we'd be sitting there going, oh my gosh, why did we ride off the rails back in 2016? Those are obviously possibilities, and I understand that. I'm having a hard time, though, thinking about those. Because what's going on in this 2016 race is so unprecedented that I feel like it's opened the door to years and years, let's be honest, decades of solutions that I thought would really, really help us all out, but were impossible to imagine happening. Because you just required so many things that were hard to imagine. I mean, you would have to have real public outrage about some things to get from A to B. And it was hard to imagine people getting that upset or getting that educated, maybe even as a group, up on some of these things. I mean, you know, those of us who look at politics, and I know many of you are too, I mean, you wouldn't be listening if you weren't a bit of a political junkie, probably. But when we look at things and you sit there and say to yourself, how often, boy, you know, if Americans really understood this, they'd be so outraged that it would never stand the light of day. It would have to be changed. But when Americans find out about these things, we find out about it individually. Do you know what I just learned? Blah, blah, blah. The country doesn't find out about it all at once. There's no way to harness the collective anger and outrage that happens when something that's pretty hard to defend becomes something that has to be defended. I'm enjoying immensely watching the head of the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, try to defend the idea of superdelegates. You know what superdelegates are, right? The party establishment figures in the Democratic Party that essentially act as, what do we call them, electoral ballast to give the party establishment the power to, as we said in an earlier show, put their hand on the scale a little bit for the candidate they favor. The optics of doing this are terrible because for a party called the Democrats, it doesn't look very democratic, does it? So it's not a tool you use unless you have to, but perhaps they think they have to. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz can't even get her story straight as to what a superdelegate is and what it's for. She's changed, you know, they have mashups, I think, on YouTube where you see her defending it, you know, from totally opposite viewpoints. The fact that she even has to defend it, though, publicly, that gets me to those kind of moments where you say, gosh, if Americans all understood at the same time and we could harness that outrage for reform, and look at what's happening over with Trump. Since the last show we did, the state of Colorado pulled out one of those little mechanisms we told you way back in early January. These parties have, and you know this, there's all sorts of shenanigans that can go on at the delegate level, right? The really granular level of politics, if the parties want to go there. You always have to weigh the importance of what you're doing next to the optics of how it's going to look, but somebody's made the decision that the optics be damned when it comes to Donald Trump. Him getting the nomination is, you know, a bigger deal. Maybe those Republican voters who are mad that what you're doing is undemocratic will run away from the party for a while, but Donald Trump stands a real chance of mortally wounding it if he hasn't already. I'd say there's a 15-20% chance he has already. Probably another 30% chance that this is a mortal wound that'll fester. Might have a new wing of the party break off. Might have the same thing happened to the Republicans that happened in the Democrats between 1968 and 1972, where you basically have an internal revolution in the party. The fact that we're even talking about this is a level of change it would have been hard for me to realistically dream about a year or two ago. So while I fully get this idea that maybe there are people who would feel a heck of a lot more comfortable if we were just in our normal, you know, establishment range of choices that we're comfortable with. Sure, it's not going to fix the problems of the day, but, you know, you won't have to worry about worst-case scenarios. You won't have to worry about something out of a Sinclair Lewis novel, right? Jimmy Hitler, Andy Stalin, an American version of something really extreme. Won't have to worry about that. You'll have a nice, reliable Mitt Romney or John McCain or Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Someone like that. I had a person write me the other day and said that they were getting over how they felt about these non-democratic tools in the toolbox that both parties have. He said, I was outraged originally that the will of the people wasn't being specifically respected, but he's so scared of Trump that he's glad that these breakwaters are there. They may be undemocratic, he said, but wouldn't we be happy if the Weimar Republic had undemocratically somehow hampered Hitler in German elections? There's a lot of people, obviously, making the Godwin's Law connection. So as I was saying, in Colorado the other day, the state of Colorado's Republican Party handed all the state's delegates to Ted Cruz. No vote. The party canceled the vote back in last August. You know, not a lot of attention was paid then. And this time they did something which is completely within the rules. They didn't violate any rules, but they also didn't let a million or so Colorado Republicans weigh in on the matter at all. And if you go to the news stories where that story is talked about, and you look after the news story at the reader comments, people are so angry. I mean, a lot of Fort Sumner-ish type stuff out there, actually, if you know what I mean. And even though we do make allowances for the typical level of, you know, internet message board hyperbole, I grade that on a curve, and even graded on a curve, you can see that the intensity is increasing. People feel ripped off. Now, if this were only on one side of the ledger, I don't think it would be as interesting to me. But to a smaller degree, I mean, you can't really compare them in terms of intensity, but you're still seeing some of this on the Democratic side, too, with how the party is stacked against Bernie Sanders. And all you have to do to see the establishment's hand openly on the scale for Hillary Clinton is look at the difference between the way the superdelegates are breaking and the way the rank-and-file Democratic electorate is breaking. I mean, if they were even close to being similar, Bernie Sanders would have a lot more superdelegates. Right now, he's getting whitewashed, whacked by Hillary. What does that tell you, right? But what's great about this, folks, is it's forced both parties to bring things out into the open they would rather not display because it doesn't look good. And it conflicts with the way that they prefer that they be seen. The parties and the media for a long time have sort of, and I think unconsciously, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think the parties do it because it just seems natural, and the media people do it because some of them, I don't think, understand even that this isn't true. But the idea that these parties are an integral constitutional conduit, whereby the design is that people are supposed to filter their votes through those parties. Those parties are supposed to sort of tabulate what the people in their party say, and then that's supposed to lead to the candidate who was ultimately chosen by those people. But that's false. Now, you can say that forever and ever on a podcast and have four or five 18-year-olds who are just learning about the system go, oh, I didn't know that, and remember it, and you made a difference. It's not the same as having everybody find out about it all at once. This is like a giant civics lesson, folks. How many people are learning about the American system of government and the real sausage-making side of it, which every country has, but, you know, that's often hidden. And it's hidden in plain sight, but it requires a level of interest that most people, unless you're maybe doing it for a living, don't have. I mean, take, for example, the nitty-gritty of delegates. How are these delegates chosen? In the state of Colorado, for example, I said they have about a million Republican voters. The will of those voters is translated into about just less than 4,000 delegates. How are delegates chosen? What's the process for that? And what does it mean, what happened in Colorado? I mean, is it an open move by the party to just sort of say, okay, you know, we don't care how bad this looks. We're going to blow open all of our sort of pseudo-marketing that says that we're a constitutional, one of two parties in a two-party system. We're going to blow that all open by admitting the truth. You don't pick the person who runs for president. We do. I've got a story that appeared on The Hill, the political website, and by Harper Nydig, but this was widely quoted in other media too, CNBC, other places. It's from March 16th, 2016, so about a month ago. The headline is, quote, GOP official, the party chooses the nominee, not the voters, by Harper Nydig, from the beginning of the piece, quote. A member of the Republican National Committee's Rules Committee said Wednesday that the party will decide who the GOP nominee will be, not the voters. Quote, "The media has created the perception that the voters will decide the nomination," Curley Haugland said in an interview with CNBC. "That's the conflict here. The political parties choose their nominees, not the general public, contrary to popular belief," he added. The story says, Haugland was then asked what the point of holding primaries is if the party can disregard the will of the voters. His answer, ladies and gentlemen, was, quote, "That's a very good question," end quote. Later in the piece, it says, Haugland, one of the party's few unbound delegates that can decide who they want to vote for, argued that the party can block Trump even if he wins 1,237 delegates through the primaries. Quote, "The primary votes are not considered at the convention. It's the delegates' votes," he said. End quote. As part of the civics lesson, Americans have learned that the rules are not quite non-existent, but darn near non-existent when it comes to how you can woo these delegates. Forget about trying to appeal to the people, the voters those delegates supposedly represent. You can treat them a little like you're recruiting college football recruits out of high school, right? Go to their home and start promising things. I saw a comic, and I'm going from memory here, but it had Ted Cruz running around like giving back rubs and serving breakfast and bringing the slippers and stuff to individual delegates. When the media says that Cruz is outworking Trump on the ground, some of that outworking is this kind of stuff. But there's nothing wrong with this. This, as both parties are starting to say openly, and that's part of the fun here, these are the rules. This is how this is done, if it needs to be done this way. And we haven't seen it in a long time. The last time we had a contested GOP convention was 1976. Been even longer since we had a contested Democratic convention. They've been coronations for most of my lifetime. This is so ancient of a concept that they are dusting off the rule books and trying to remember how it's done. Trump brought in someone who's essentially like a dinosaur in the business, who remembers and was active in the 76 contested convention, where Ronald Reagan challenged the sitting Republican president, Gerald Ford. That's just a sign of how the institutional memory has so forgotten what a contested convention, really how they're supposed to function traditionally, how that even goes. It's like a giant civics lesson for Americans to see how the horse trading is, though, because a lot of people all of a sudden are realizing just how manipulatable all this is and just how really private an entity these parties are. Everybody's saying, I mean, Ben, if there is a Ben, said to me the other day, he goes, all of a sudden everybody's saying everywhere, these parties aren't really government entities and they don't have to do this. And this is great. We've been talking about this for a long time. How wonderful is it to have an exposure moment where a lot of people all at once, due to the civics lesson, are going, I didn't know that. Did you know that? And then venting their outrage. I have this image in my head that the peasants have picked up the torches and pitchforks, and all of a sudden everybody feels scared because you don't know what those peasants will do. They're going to burn down the right thing. They could burn down the wrong thing. They're scary when they get uppity. But here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. We weren't going to get any kind of change, good, bad, or otherwise, unless people did. A certain amount of energy is required to accomplish anything. And a year or two ago, all of these solutions I would throw out seemed ridiculous because you couldn't figure out how you were ever going to get past the big roadblock, which is how do you get people angry and energized enough to push for these things? You got to have enough pushback to deal with the inertia of the way things are. It's fighting the reality, and let's be honest, all the investment money. I mean, there's a ton of investment of all kinds that go into keeping things the way they are. It's how you bet on things. I mean, it's always tough to overcome the inertia. But if people become angry enough, you can change all sorts of realities. But a year or two ago, you're going, when is that going to happen? How is that going to happen? Well, who foresaw 2016? And as I said, it can't just be on one side. If you want to make this where everyone has a systemic awakening moment where they go, wait a minute, this system's got problems that need reform. It has to happen to both parties at once. It can't look like a failing of an individual party. Those Republicans are just falling apart. You have to say, no, look, the Democrats are doing it too. I mean, all of a sudden, people are seeing how manipulatable things are and how their range of choices is artificially constrained and how they have very little option of increasing that under the current system. Laura Ingraham, talk show host, had a Colorado Republican official, or former one, that she interviewed talking about the party utilizing some of these things to block Trump's progress, regardless of what Republican voters might want. And then he talked about how delegates are picked. Listen to how, you know, this process where really this is where granular politics happens at the delegate level. Listen to how delegates are chosen. So this is Ingraham talking to this former Colorado State Republican Party Chairman Ryan Call. This is quoted off the Real Clear Politics website. The host, Laura Ingraham, says, quote, "The August 25th announcement that Colorado would no longer do the presidential preference poll at their caucus, my spidey senses went up when that happened. Was I correct to, at the time, note that this was a sign that they were not going to be bound by the people of Colorado selecting Trump? If that was a risk," she asks, "they wanted to cut that off at the pass in August. Am I correct in saying that?" Call says, quote, "That's exactly right. While the caucus votes we've held in previous elections in 2008 and 2012 were always straw polls, they didn't bind or allocate the delegations. They at least were a snapshot into where voter sentiment is in the state of Colorado. And the decision by the state Republican Party to cancel that vote, taken in connection with the caucus, really did cut out any semblance of democracy or the popular will in contention with the delegate election event. It became an entire party insider's game," he says, "with getting delegates to go to county assemblies in the state convention. While Colorado has over 1 million registered Republican voters, the only votes that really counted were that of the 3,900 delegates that gathered down in Colorado Springs." End quote. Ingraham then says, quote, "How do you become a delegate in Colorado? Does it tend to be more people who are activists within the party? Is there a Tea Party element? How does that play out?" And then Call answers. Now think about this, folks. This is the conduit through which the will of the people has to travel. Quote, "So Colorado has a lot of different elements. Tea Party elements, strong Second Amendment and pro-life supporters. It's a very diverse coalition. And lots of factions are involved in the party. But the process to become a delegate, to be able to have your voice heard in the process, is admittedly cumbersome, convoluted, complicated, and not friendly to folks that are political novices or are new at this process. You would have to show up at your local neighborhood caucuses back in March 1st, and sit through 2 or 3 hour meetings, get elected from among your neighbors at the local neighborhood precinct caucus to go attend a county assembly. Then from the county assembly, you had to convince a few hundred or 1,000 delegates at the county assembly to move you on to attend the congressional district or the state convention process. Then you had to show up at the state convention, and as has been widely reported, you had 10 seconds to make your pitch to the 3,900 delegates at the state assembly of why they should elect you to go to Cleveland." End quote. Did you guys catch that? How long these delegates have to give a presentation, you know, trying to get included with the rest of the delegates? So I have 10 seconds to make my case? CNN shot some video of this that I saw online, and all these delegate wannabes have time to do is to think of, I think one went up there and they have to announce their number, and he said something like 114, Trump, 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 and then, you know, walked off. I mean, there's not much else you could do. It's like speed dating for delegates. But it also shows that the people picking the delegates can't possibly know much about them. A lot of people who wanted to be Trump delegates said that simply by saying they wanted to be Trump delegates got them disqualified. I can't vouch for the validity of that, but it's a perfect example of places where elections can get influenced. Remember, it's not how many votes you get, it's how many delegates. And if there is a contested convention, remember, that gets really kooky because most of these delegates are supposed to vote on the first ballot the way they said they would, the way that the party expects them to. But the next vote after that, a large chunk of them can vote any way they want. The next vote after that, a larger chunk of them can vote any way they want. There are some Americans in there that have an enormous amount of power and apparently had about 10 seconds to explain to the other people in their situation how they'd use it if they got it. Folks, anger is an energy. That was the title of a book I just finished by John Lydon, the former lead singer of the Sex Pistols, but it's a fantastic point. I think in our modern society, the current default setting, if you said, you know, is anger a positive or a negative emotion, is to assume it's a negative emotion, but it really does depend on what you do with it, doesn't it? I mean, if you're one of those people in the 1950s or 1960s that was appalled seeing the famous, you know, there's an iconic Life magazine photograph, for example, of police dogs being unleashed against civil rights protesters. And if you saw that and it made you angry, angry enough to begin to work to see things change, that anger wasn't a negative emotion. That anger was positive, wasn't it? Americans have been getting angry all the time about our political system, but it really only works when we all do it together. Because if you look at so many of the solutions that would help make some of these outrages that have people angry now go away, we have to get them through Democrats and Republicans. It's what we've said all along, that expecting those people to redesign the electoral system to make it easier for other people to compete or to lessen their advantages is like asking the fox how he wants to redesign the chicken coop. How do you get past that dynamic? I mean, even if we have an exposure moment here, as I said, I like to call this a reformatunity, right? An opportunity for reform. Even if we have a relatively broad consensus that there needs to be changes to make this more a translation of what American voters want with less interference in between, we have to somehow enunciate that through the Democrats and Republican legislators. They're the ones who have to craft the actual rule changes. The only way they're going to do that is if people are really mad. They're only going to do that if they have to. So if you're a person who's hoping for positive change, you're not going to get that unless the anger reaches a certain level of intensity and unless it's sort of across the political spectrum. Well, I can't help but notice, I kind of see that right now. And while I'm perfectly aware that there are historical roads looming that we could take that would be disasters, we had to get past this bridge to have a chance to get to any of those good possible outcomes too. I mean, this was a necessary step that had to happen for any of, well, not just yours truly, but a lot of people's ideas for reform happen. I mean, how long have I wanted more parties? Well, there's a lot of talk and perhaps a decent chance you're going to see the Republicans split after this election, depending on what happens in the election and how it's handled. You could see that in the Democratic Party maybe too. And I hope we all understand that the two parties under the current system are not really afraid of that too much. I mean, they'd rather not lose the voters, but they're not scared that this new party is going to be any threat to them personally. That's because they understand how things are stacked in the electoral system against any new parties or independents. Could the anger that is the energy that could prompt reform here, could we overcome that? Could we take the idea to the next logical conclusion and look and say, listen, just because we have a Libertarian Party or a Green Party or a Reform Party doesn't mean that they can compete. I think the sheer fact that you can look at how many of those people are actually winning elections, and I can hear libertarians saying, now, do you know how many libertarian legislators there are in the lower level? Okay, come on, we're talking about the big game here, okay? Congress, the Senate, the presidency. It's not quite a shutout, but it almost is. From that, you can determine, just like you could determine the need for affirmative action perhaps in some industries when they're, you know, 100% one color forever, and you say, but we don't discriminate. Well, I can look at that and just think there has to be something going on. Couldn't you call this an act of collusion when you look at the various things that are used state to state to state to make it next to impossible that people outside those two parties can compete? There's a reason people think we have a two-party system. It's because there's only two parties that realistically have a chance. It's why a guy who was an independent his whole career, until just recently, Bernie Sanders decides to run as a Democrat and openly says, you know, it's for realistic reasons. Democrats and Republicans are the only people who win these things. It's why Donald Trump, who's probably more of an independent, decides to run as a Republican, because they're realists. Should the system be that way? I mean, how often do we vote for the lesser of two evils because two evils are all we really have up there? So part of what begins to become imaginable due to the current level of outrage that seeing how things kind of really work has generated is that we could turn around and begin to acknowledge that just having these third parties is not going to make anything viable. You've got to give them a chance to compete. This could be the kind of anger that forces, and this would have to happen state by state because that's where the roadblocks are, you know, some of these roadblocks to be demolished, to make it indefensible to do things that inhibit competition. And that's maybe one of the best parts about this exposure moment, that just like Debbie Wasserman Schultz having to defend what in a Democratic Party sounds pretty indefensible, the superdelegates, so much of what's going on here is kind of indefensible, but nobody's ever called on to defend it. If Americans are angry enough about things like ballot access laws, for example, to just, you know, take one thing and how hard it is to get on a ballot, Democrats and Republicans automatically get on ballots. Why is that? I mean, some of these states have weird access laws. I mean, yeah, go look it up. That's a good way to go look up things like ballot access laws and see how much that already slants a playing field against people who start with amazing odds against them just because they don't want to run as a Democrat or Republican. Is that the way we want it? Do we have a choice? And again, the problem is that when we decide we want it differently, we then have to get that past Democrats and Republicans for the actual legislating to get done. And they're not going to like this. I mean, that's only human. Are we angry enough to push through that, to make it indefensible to sit there and continue to hold down any competition in a system where we constantly talk about the real-world practical values of competition? Competition makes us better, right? Hardens steel against steel, whatever you want to say. Forces the good ideas to the fore. There's a lot of, you know, known advantages to competition. I can hear you people who like to push cooperation too. A lot of good things with cooperation, not putting that down either. But my point is if you believe in a free market system because competition's best, how do we justify what we have now in the political realm? And doesn't it sort of explain why we're not getting better people, better candidates, better ideas, and more progress? It's Coke and Pepsi, it's Hertz and Avis, it's the big two companies, Microsoft and Apple. I mean, come on, it's the big two companies, and they don't have to worry about much else except that other guy. And guess what? We're both making money, so, you know, worst case scenario. Number two is not that bad either. I mean, folks, we see this in the private sector all the time. You see it in the consumer market all the time. And you know what usually happens? What usually happens is eventually somebody sues, and maybe somebody gets called a monopoly or a duopoly, or collusion gets brought up, or antitrust ideas get thrown out there. There have been a few lawsuits against aspects of this before. It seems to me that maybe the courts, too, are a way around what the legislators might want. Gary Johnson, a Libertarian candidate for president, in 2012 sued, I don't remember, was it antitrust? He was suing for access to the debates. And, of course, the debate access to the Democrat and Republican candidate, anyway, is controlled by a private entity, too, with a board of directors composed of half Republicans and half Democrats, who automatically include Republicans and Democrats, but get to decide if they want to include anyone else and what the rules for inclusion are. And since they changed the rules after Ross Perot got into the debates in 1992 under the old standards, so they raised the standards and changed the standards, and there hasn't been a third person in the debate since. Ralph Nader tried and involved, you know, legal avenues, Gary Johnson, like I just said, suing. But one might think that there's almost like a bombshell legally in the distance, if you did it right, that reminds you of, you know, like how baseball had to eventually allow free agency and all those kinds of things. I mean, can you imagine a court decision saying that not only do these parties get colluded against, but in order to give them a critical mass where they could compete in a market that's so saturated by the number one and number two competitors, you almost needed an affirmative action type program, affirmative action for third party and independents. Another thing we could do is bring up some of these electoral reform ideas that get bantered around in discussion sometimes, but have no connection to reality when you talk about the ability to implement them. When things get wiggy like they are now, all bets are off in terms of what might be possible. When the pitchforks and the torches are out there and people get angry enough, it's scary how much power we actually have in this system if we decide to use it all together. I know it's scaring other Americans. I mean, I think the people roused in any system are scary. Even those systems where the people are held in the grip of a totalitarian government, it's frightening when they get out in the streets together and start bringing buildings and statues down. So let's not undervalue what might be possible if people are concerned enough, angry enough, distressed enough, or they feel ripped off. I mean, when you read those comments after those Donald Trump stories of him not getting any delegates and there being no vote in Colorado for the delegates, well, the first thing that's happening is you have a lot of people saying, I will never vote Republican again. The next thing they're going to notice is who you're going to vote for. We're going to have some opportunities for change that did not exist before this election. Donald Trump maybe is a kind of a historical arsonist, no matter what else you think of him. He may be setting fire to the duopoly here, and Bernie Sanders is helping get more firewood. Bernie Sanders is the only one out there making sure that this isn't viewed as just a Republican problem, because he's forcing the Democrats to openly put their hands on the scale, too, and demonstrate what, again, if you're a political nerd, you already knew, but the rest of the country's waking up to, that these parties are not a constitutional part of the system that has to listen to you or that is forced to play a certain role that, you know, you think is in your high school civics textbook. Now, they may be required to work in the public interest as part of their, you know, corporate structure or whatnot, but the point is that that's open to interpretation, too. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are forcing both parties to publicly defend the indefensible. And I've often thought that if you could just shine a light on some of these issues, the basic unfairness of it would force it to sort of just collapse like a house of cards. So what would have to happen for that to occur? Well, I think the beginnings of it happened in Colorado with Trump. How much more of this could the system absorb? What if it happens in another state that Trump needs to win? And boom, again, no votes or some other shenanigans that are so open, well, that we just double down on the anger that I'm seeing, which, as I said, allowing for internet message board hyperbole inflation, is Fort Sumner-ish in some respects. Where does that go if it happens to him again? And in Bernie Sanders' case, he's won like 7 primary and caucus votes in a row, and the superdelegates are just killing him. What's going to happen if this momentum continues, but progress towards a goal doesn't? And what if it's obviously because the party is holding him back? How angry do people get? And what do we do with this anger? It's a rare thing, as I said, that we all get angry at once. It's a rare thing that we all notice something in the system at once. And it's a rare thing that when it happens, it involves a cross spectrum of the American electorate's ideas and not just one side or the other. All these things put together create a reformatunity. Can public opinion coalesce around the idea of electoral reform? Can we turn around and use the anger and the dismay and the dissatisfaction and the sense of being ripped off that so many people have now and say, listen, it doesn't have to be this way. We may not agree on what we want for the country, but we can all agree that we liked the myth that we had before we found out this is the way it really runs better than we like this. How can we get more toward the myth? People have all kinds of ideas. Go online and look. People will talk about reforming the idea of first-past-the-post voting. Others will talk about preference voting. Maybe we could talk, you know, about something that's been around and was largely influenced by slavery in the southern states, the Electoral College. Maybe it's time for that to go. Do a straight vote for the president. There's a lot of ideas. All of them share the same problem a year ago. How do you ever get any of them enacted, especially past Democrats and Republicans? People would have to be so insistent. And the idea of defending reform when things were so openly one-sided would have to be so obvious that it just wasn't really realistically imaginable a year ago. But then nobody saw this coming, what we're going through right now. An absolutely one-of-a-kind, never happened before in my lifetime. Really, if you look at it, I haven't seen anything in the 20th century even that is like what we have now. It's an unprecedented time. It creates a reformatunity and provides the electorate a rare chance to wrench control of the system back into their hands and have one of those moments in American history, and they're all through your history textbooks, aren't they? Reform moments. They happen all the time. You have a Watergate, boom, you have a reform period afterwards to deal with the, you know, things that became apparent. You have a Great Depression? Believe me, that's a reform opportunity. The country is so different in 1928 than it is in 1938, and people in 1928 could not have imagined the changes that would occur, but of course they couldn't have imagined the Great Depression either. Those kinds of things create reform opportunities too. A lot of Americans have been in denial about the kind of things that our system has been doing in terms of cutting them out of it. And I don't blame anybody, by the way. It's tough to pay attention to politics. I mean, as I said, if you wanted to understand what was going on with delegates, look at how much of a politics nerd you would have to be. In this economy, in this country right now, and the way things are, most people are devoting about 100% of their mental attention to just living their lives and paying their bills and raising their kids. And it's hard to have an interest and it's hard to care. And most of the time, there's no point because you're not going to change anything anyway. But then things happen sometimes to drag your attention away collectively at the same time. And you get a civics lesson and you get angry. And for a short period of time, worrying about the state of the country and your political system becomes important to all those other things you normally care about more. When people's personal needs dovetails with their civic responsibility, it creates a climate that's just ripe for change. A rare situation, by the way, in U.S. history, but it has come and gone several times. And you see a reaction to imbalances. Maybe you have a Gilded Age, and then you have an era of a couple of, you know, at the time, progressive presidents like Roosevelt and Wilson, who are a response to that. You have a Depression, and then you have an FDR who's a response to that. You have a Vietnam War and a Watergate, and you have a climate in the 1970s that's a response to that, and then you have a Reagan/Goldwater revolution that's a response to that. So, I mean, there's a lot of this cause and effect going on in the U.S. political system. We can take advantage of that now. The anger and the understanding and the collective outrage over the way this is playing out and how much of what you find out now conflicts with what your image and what you think this is supposed to be about gives us an opportunity to maybe make it more like you think it was. As I said, living up to the myths a little bit more. This country has a 200-plus-year-old history of becoming more democratic over time. I mean, once upon a time, senators, for example, were appointed positions, right? And we all understand how the franchise has been expanded since the very beginning. It wasn't even just white men once upon a time. It was some white men. So obviously, a long history of becoming less like a republic and more like a democratic society. One could argue, though, that that's progress that's been stalled too long. We've skipped a couple of maintenance appointments, you know, for oil changes, and the oil's really dirty right now. So we might have to replace a few parts and flush things out that we wouldn't have had to do before. It's a tougher time to get the kind of reform you need if you haven't been updated in a while. The job is somewhat larger, somewhat harder to contemplate, and during normal times, the odds are small that you'll get that kind of change. No one wants to take those chances, spend that money, you know, whatever it might be. And then you get opportunities, reform opportunities, like what we have now. I mentioned a few shows ago, you know, when I was in a more doom and gloom mood. I'm not in a doom and gloom mood now. I'm just in one of my contrarian moments. But I mentioned my concerns about the 2020 presidential election and how if the cynical people in the Democratic and Republican Party structure who are assuming that everything after the election, all this anger will just die down and people will forget and they'll go back to their regular lives and it'll all be fine. If they're wrong, think of how scary 2020 could be. If the white-hot level of internet message board hyperbole is where it is now, where's it going to be in 4 years? Especially if the outcome of this election makes it look like Donald Trump had the election stolen from him by the party, or Bernie Sanders would have won except for this. I mean, whatever it might be, the way this plays out will impact how angry and how bad of a taste it leaves in voters' mouths. But we have 4 years here to figure out a positive way that the anger in our system right now can be used. It's an energy. It doesn't have to be negative, but the outlets that are there right now are not good enough to do the job. I mean, you could say something like, listen, if all these Trump supporters want to roll up their sleeves and do something good with their anger, they should go start a new party. Well, that might have worked a while back. Now, too many people are aware, you know, of what the odds are of that. It's a fool's errand. You're going to go waste all your energy, and behind your back, the parties are just going to laugh at you because they know what the odds are because they've influenced those odds in every state in the country. You got to change that. You've got to make these realistic safety valves. Otherwise, people aren't going to buy that anymore. They've watched how electors are chosen. They've watched how parties, you know, treat delegates. They're aware, you know, that these two parties are their own entities now. I know the parties are hoping that the memory of the American people is short, and they may be right, but if they're not, 2020 looks bad. And the peasants with the pitchforks and the torches are going to be more unpredictable and more willing to vote for the Jimmy Hitler, Andy Stalin candidate that will most appeal to their desire to burn down a rotting ship that denied them what they felt was their rightful due 4 years previously. If you can see that coming, we can head that off at the pass, and in the most positive way, by getting the reform that will do it for us. The only problem is the Democrats and the Republicans have to also look 4 years ahead and think to themselves, even we will be better off, and our system will be healthier. And then, you know, giving up these advantages that we've long maintained will actually create a healthier system where we're less in danger in 4 years than if we don't. Because if they don't, and if they're wrong about the anger cooling, they're going to be the principal targets of the voters' anger in 2020. Do you really want to be in those crosshairs? Do you really want the peasants with the torches and the pitchforks mad at you? I think Democrats and Republicans individually are all smart enough to see that. But collectively, that's a different question. I'll tell you something, though, and I also think this is a hopeful sign. It's not just people who feel like political outsiders that are angry with what's been exposed here, you know, so far in the presidential election by how things really work. I think there's a lot of people in both parties that are appalled also. I think there's people within, and lots of people, who are Hillary Clinton supporters, you know, the perceived beneficiary of the superdelegate idea right now, who think that that idea stinks. And who don't like the answers that their DNC chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, gives them about this any more than anybody else does. And I know that there are Republicans, including a lot of people who do not support Trump, who are angry with the way, you know, he's being treated. In other words, the anger extends not just to those who feel like the two parties are part of the problem, but those who feel like the two parties are part of the solution too, members of them. When that happens, that means we have a large chunk of the people out there, including party members, that want to see a change. Again, I think that increases the opportunities. I haven't seen a climate that's been so maybe open to the possibilities. It seems so fertile for something to happen. Now, the problem is, of course, we could have giant weeds and call them Jimmy Hitler grow in our fertile garden. But, you know, if we're going to grow anything new, this is what we have to do it. And we have 4 years to channel the anger and the outrage and the dissatisfaction into things that make us better, that harness the energy of our people that is normally elsewhere. You know, we're not exactly this huge civic-minded country these days, folks, and you kind of have to be to make it work. And we're several oil changes overdue, and now people care enough. Anger is an energy. It's nice to see the electorate getting an infusion of energy. The next step is to make sure that they have positive outlets for it. Because anger without positive outlets sort of by default leads to negative outcomes, doesn't it? We have 4 years to get this right. Let's not forget what this feels like, ladies and gentlemen, or we're going to re-experience it only more intensely in 4 years. Audible is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment. More than 180,000 titles now and growing all the time. Every genre you can think of, many more categories than just audiobooks for sure. And a sure sign of how far audiobooks in general have come is how quickly you can see brand new titles released in audio form, often simultaneously with the text-based hardcover release. I mean, take for example the book I want to recommend to you from Audible today. Andrew Bacevich's brand new one only came out April 5th, called America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. I know many of you have read Basevich's former books. He's one of the most insightful, interesting commentators on American military affairs going today. He has a very unique perspective. Former, I believe, lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, what we would have called a lifer, who then goes into academia. And so he has this sort of, you know, dual lens view of things that's pretty much unique, I think. In addition, he was one of the first guests we ever had on the Common Sense program. And when we did, his son had not yet gone off to war. He subsequently lost a son in these conflicts in the Middle East. He's got a very unique perspective, and he's reform-minded, pragmatic, I would say common sense-oriented. I had a chance to spend some time with him in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago, and I was thoroughly impressed. I told him I would be, you know, he would be a defense secretary if I had any say in the matter, and it's probably lucky for everybody, including Andrew Basevich, that I don't. Nonetheless, to me, I don't know how you can say you're up on these sorts of affairs if Basevich is not part of your, you know, reading list. You might want to pick up America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. I just did. And you can get a free 30-day trial if you sign up with Audible now. And to do that, you go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin.
If you are not already following us on Twitter, please do so. The address is @DC Common Sense.
Hey, are you feeling guilty yet? Come on, a buck a show. That's all we ask.
Go to DanCarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.